Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and we're going to talk about something I mentioned about a month ago, where I suggested to a caller coconut oil is a great way to repel insects. Well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture recently revealed that coconut oil could ward off insects better than DEET, the main ingredient in insect repellent products. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Scientific Reports. So, good to know that what we are working with is ahead of the curve. We have a lot of science to share with you today, always in lay language and always ways that we can use to live a longer and healthier life. Also today, I'm going to do some commentaries, some of my own that I think about. Generally, when I'm, and it's interesting, when I'm out working out and where there's no distractions and thoughts come into my mind, and then I think that would be an interesting topic. But also today from Counterpunch, John Whitehead, Uncle Sam, and what he's doing to create a nation of suspects for the FBI. That I'll be sharing with you. I have a lot of respect for John Whitehead. He's one of the best constitutional attorneys in the world, along with Danny Sheehan, and who we just spoke with, and Danny's working with us on a major case right now. Also today, some leaked documents expose how corporations use spies to subvert people's movements, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. I thought you'd find this of interest. This is from Common Dreams, and we see it all the time. I even have seen it at retreats. I've seen it at in different things that I've done where someone's there to cause trouble and dissent and to gossip and be malicious. And then we find out that they weren't who they said they were, and they were just an agent provocateur. I wonder how many agent provocateurs Pacific has had, and I've never seen an investigation to prove that people are not provocateurs. They're everywhere, and we'll share that. Also, I didn't have a chance yesterday to play the piece by one of the leading intellectual feminists in the world, Camille Paglia, but we're going to have a segment on today where she discusses her views, and agree or disagree, she is certainly one of the most important voices on controversial feminism, and we need to hear what it is. And then we'll take time, if you'd like, to share your comments and points of view, by all means do. Also today, we have, and I haven't heard it anywhere, the leaked report from the OPCW, the official investigation into the Syrian gas tanks. And they're claiming it was staged. This is an MIT scientist. You're going to hear him. So every time we were saying invade Syria, they're gassing their own people. No, Assad wasn't gassing his own people. Three separate investigations by three separate reporters, including Seymour Hersh, shows that it was the U.S. and its backed terrorist groups in Syria that we're doing this. So we'll play that as well. I'll be taking the voicemails. Our voicemail line is 862-800-6805. A lot of people, the vast majority of the people, listen to this program over the archives. Let me give you that number, because no matter where you're at, you can download the show up to five with one phone call. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And that way you can hear anything you want. Let's begin with health and healing. As I mentioned, that coconut oil, I put it on all over the body, and it's very good to put on your scalp at night, massage it into your hair. Used to be olive oil. You can actually combine a teaspoon of olive oil and a teaspoon of coconut oil, massage it around, then massage it for about 5 or 6 minutes into your head. It's also good to massage into your feet as well, and because you have a lot of sensory points in your feet, nerve endings that go to other parts of your body, and that's very healthy. So anyhow, why? Why would it be better than DEET, which is very toxic at getting rid of mosquitoes, ticks, biting flies, and bed bugs? Yeah, bed bugs. It's because the fatty acids that were derived from coconut oil include lauric, L-A-U-R-I-C acid, capric acid, C-A-P-R-I-C, and caprylic acid. Caprylic acid also is what you get when you bite into a grapefruit seed. It's very, very good for you. And also their corresponding methyl esters. And DEET is the most commonly used of these, and it's very toxic. I would never use it, not as a roll-on, not as a stick-on, not as a lotion, not as a spray. Just read up on how toxic it is in U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's papers on it. Also, flax seeds, just 1 ounce a day, can extend your life. This is from the Canadian Center for Agri-Food Research and Health and Medicine. And they're stating, in an article published in Experimental Gerontology, that the flax seed positively impacts age-associated changes in inflammation, adding to an already extensive list of benefits that we know are good. It's good for your heart. And the flax seeds are good because of what are called oxyliptins, O-X-Y-L-I-P-I-N-S. That's a category of physiologically bioactive molecules produced in the body from the oxidation of polyunsaturated fatty acids. And oxylipid derivatives are believed to play a critical role in chronic disease progression, as well as in the aging process by modulating both inflammatory and anti-inflammatory pathways in the body. So when you have something like the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids and that protect the heart, that turn off inflammation, then what you're doing, you're down-regulating, meaning turning the thermostat down and on inflammation in the body, and that's preventing the activation of certain immune cells. And that's important, like the polymorphonuclear neutrophils. On the other hand, those derived from the omega-6 fatty acids, or its derivative arachidonic acid, when you eat meat, a hamburger, when you have chicken, any of those meat items, you're turning on arachidonic acid, and that's pro-inflammatory. So for those on a high-protein diet, those on the paleo diet, these different diets, every time you eat those diets, you're turning on inflammation in the body. Now, why is that important? Let's pull back for a moment and just look for a second like a classroom on the air. And I actually remember doing this lecture way back. Some of you might have attended it. It was packed. It was at the New School where I taught for years. And I tried to explain why there's no such thing as a disease normal to the aging process. And people were arguing, but that's not true. Diabetes and heart disease and dementia and senility, macular degeneration and fatigue. And I said, none of those are normal to the aging process, but they are all normal to the disease process. And what is the difference? The difference is inflammation. So anything that you do that increases oxidative stress is increasing inflammation. Anything that increases inflammation is increasing the alteration of your DNA. Now let's just say for our argument's sake that you have about 75 trillion cells in the body. Some people have more, some people have less, depending upon the size of the body. Now we know that we have about more or less 10,000 gene alterations per 24 hours, for every single one of those 75 trillion cells. Now, at the end of a cell, you have a chromosome being protected by a cap that is called a telomere. And there's an enzyme, telomerase, that allows the telomere to stay strong. But inflammation causes it to become weak and unravel. As these telomeres unravel, they expose the chromosomes. The chromosomes then become altered, and you alter your chromosomes, you literally can speed up the death of that whole cell line. So when you have your coffee, that's pro-inflammatory. Now, again, the confusion is there are some benefits to the green coffee beans and to some of the polyphenols and antioxidants in coffee. But at the same time, there's a whole cascade of negative effects. Now, this is something I know intimately, more so than the average scientist, because I spent 2 years in clinical research, both in vivo and vitro, at the Institute of Applied Biology, doing my thesis in my Human Nutrition and Public Health Science multi-dimensional degree. It was the first, by the way, it's not in my nature to go through all the things I've achieved, and I don't. But when someone tries to mock my educational background or write something like Stephen Baird that attacks my thesis, that was published in a peer-reviewed journal, one of the most respected. None of my findings were ever refuted. And I laid out a very compelling argument of what caffeine does to constrict blood flow to the brain, what it does to become highly anabolic. And highly anabolic means you're going to a more acidic state, and that's pro-inflammatory. So just having a cup of coffee by itself also creates an increase in GERD, and where you're regurgitating hydrochloric acid from your stomach back into your esophagus, and that increases the risk of esophageal cancers and ulcers of the esophagus. And it's one of the fastest increasing cancers in the world, because the increase in hot beverages, the temperature of the beverage as well as the caffeine, both create this. Because we've gotten used to drinking things hot, and the body cannot take hot foods. You should never eat hot foods, any hot foods. You should eat them pleasantly warm so it doesn't burn your tongue or your esophagus or your stomach. In any case, I remember doing the work of taking a group of people who had been on caffeine and a group of people who had never used caffeine. To the group who had never used caffeine, they were taking caffeine, the group that was on caffeine, taking them off, and then measuring with the medical team, measuring the actual physiological dynamics. And you talk about going through headaches and fatigue and muscle spasms, withdrawal from caffeine. Well, just think of that for a moment. Anything that can cause such a radical physiological reaction, like severe migraines, splitting headaches, inability to sleep, irritability, is not good for you. And the people who then became highly involved in using caffeine, we had to wean them off. I have a program for detoxifying from caffeine and sugar and cocaine and methamphetamine and everything else. But that was important original research, because no one had published a paper that I could find in the scientific literature to compare with the depth of things that we found wrong with caffeine. Yes, there were some things that were okay, but the vast majority that were wrong were really wrong. So I just say that because every time you have that cup of coffee, you're creating pro-inflammatory cytokines. So now let's say that you have breakfast. And let's just say that you're not a big health advocate. It's not a priority, but you're also not into junk foods. You're maybe wanting to keep your weight. You probably exercise, go to a gym, do Pilates classes, which are good for you. And so let's say that you had a bagel with cream cheese. Both are pro-inflammatory. The gluten, the browning creates acrylamides. The cream cheese, highly allergic reactions if you're dairy sensitive. And then you have your coffee, pro-inflammatory. So right off the bat, you have three inflammatory agents you're putting in your body to start the day. Now, what you add throughout the day, you might think it's good to have a tuna fish sandwich because you heard that it's low in calories and high in protein, good for you. None of that is true. First off, it's dead. And if it's dead, you bury it. You don't eat it. But we have this ritual. We have strange rituals. Coming from the South, where they put dead people in a casket for everybody to go around, have a picnic, just always seemed a little strange to me. Imagine before they had embalming fluid. Wow. In the summertime. Stupid things. You want to do something good with the body that's dead? There's a way now that you can plant a tree using the body as compost. That would be terrific. That's leaving a legacy, something that will grow after a person dies, something that can help the earth and be a part of our greening. In any case, any time that we are consuming anything that's a pro-inflammatory, we're adding to that 10,000 gene alterations per day. So two people, one who are very conscious about no pro-inflammatories at all, they'll start the day with a fresh glass of juice and put in some lemon and apple cider vinegar and manuka honey and ginger and some green apples and celery and cucumbers. They're cleaning their cells. They're cleaning their blood. They're thinning the blood. They're preventing strokes. They're energizing with oxygen into the tissue. Their blood is redder. It's carrying more heme. It's carrying more oxygen into the cells. Everything you could do good is good. And it's turning off inflammation. And it's allowing the body then to go after inflammation into healing. So now that person is going to go from 10,000 gene alterations per day, maybe down to about 4,000. But then let's say they get really smart. They become intentionally aware of nutrition, and they start looking up, what's good for my heart? Well, coenzyme Q10 and magnesium, cayenne, L-carnitine, vitamin E, tocotrienols. Okay, hawthorn. Well, I want all that. Good. So now you go from turning on inflammation to turning it off and now healing. Now you're down to about 2,000 gene alterations per day. You're exercising, but you're compensating for the oxidative stress, which is inflammatory, from running because you're taking your nutrients before and after your workout, therefore protecting your body as you're working out and compensating by trapping the free radicals created by the exercise itself. So you benefit from the endorphins, feel good hormones. You're benefiting from intestinal peristalsis, speeding up more regular and complete bowel movements, lessening colorectal cancer and itises in the intestine. You also are increasing digestion. You're enhancing microcirculation. All good. Now let's bring that down to 1,000 gene alterations per day. Then you start meditating and doing yoga and meditation and prayer, things that relax you, calm you, allow you to feel good. These are the things that are important. Now you're both 60. One of you looks 90. The other looks 40. Because today you can legitimately say that 70 is the new 45. That 50 is the new 35. If you do it all. And that's the key. Some people can, others won't. I won't get into it today, but I'm going to do a webinar in the very near future on how to add 30 years, healthy years, to your lifespan, no matter what your age. That's coming up, and then I go into great depth, the biochemical level, what's really happening. I'm just giving you a general overview like a classroom on the air, just to let you know why it's so important when you have something that's a pro-inflammatory lifestyle and how flax seeds are one of 1,000 items that can be anti-inflammatory, and we want anti-inflammatory into our lives. And by the way, one of the most important things is pro or anti-inflammatory is quality of a relationship. A wonderful, loving, growing, passionate, exciting, creative relationship is one of the greatest virtues of life. And we should all be so fortunate, blessed to have one of those in our lives. Some people have several. Some people have none. The danger is if we have a bad relationship, we suddenly start to prejudge other ones or become reluctant for another relationship because of the experiences of the previous one. And I do not believe that is fair. Because think of all the wonderful human beings you could spend quality time with, share the best of your nature with, grow with, if you trust in your intuition and your judgments about whether or not someone should or should not, or you should be in their lives. Too many people are walking backwards through life because of the pain that they have felt being victimized by circumstances that they were unprepared for. And that's all pro-inflammatory. That's a double negative. Because when you feel like a victim, you're going to be depressed and apathetic. when you're feeling like an apathetic victim and you're depressed, you really turn on the pro-inflammatory cytokines and free radicals. And therefore, whatever your chronological age, you're a lot older biologically. Lots older. That's why stress kills. Anyhow, that's just a little extemporaneous discussion off the omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. And why when you eat meat, or you eat that tuna, it's got mercury, it's got lead, it is denatured protein, it's not vital, it doesn't have vitalism, it's hurting us. And therefore, find something you could eat that you could enjoy, that's healthy and vital and alive. And finally, in another study from the Indian Council of Medical Research, that would be equivalent to our like National Academy of Sciences, they find that antioxidant therapy with polyphenols can reverse endothelial dysfunction. And that means that by, and this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition, that means that when you're taking in polyphenols, what do I mean? I mean the nutrients in blueberries, strawberries, raspberries, tart monobranchii, cherries, elderberries, acai berries, goji berries, logan berries, all these wonderful berries, they're rich, rich, rich in polyphenols. And that helps with the endothelium, which is the thin inner lining of cells in blood vessels that acts as an interface between the circulatory blood and the vessel wall, making it a critical mediator within the vascular system. And the endothelial dysfunction, meaning you're not eating right, and you have little rips and tears and cuts and abrasions and lesions. And that's common in diabetics, pre-diabetics, and people with heart disease. So one of the most important indicators of how long you're going to live is how healthy your endothelium is. And pomegranate is one of the best things in the world for your endothelium. And I have helped people. In fact, this is interesting. I don't know if, Jesse, if you're listening in the studio right now, there was a young woman who was from Tennessee. She has a strong Tennessee accent. She was severely diabetic, on multiple medications, morbidly obese, lots of pain, and in one, I think she was there 1 week, maybe two, and this would have gone back 6 months ago. And just by flooding her body with a special protocol that I put together, we dropped 103 points off her blood sugar in 1 week with no medications. And on the last day, when I said, who would like to go for a walk? And I just said, a walk, that's it. And we had a whole team of doctors and nurses and everyone out there. It's a short walk out and back. We can see almost the whole distance. But I said, if any of you get tired, don't worry. We'll have a golf cart there and we'll just pick you up. Okay. So they didn't know if they were going to go a half a mile. She could probably have gone maybe when she came 100 feet. That's it. And she just kept going and going. So all the guests came down and we set up a table. And we had all the juices. And I said, put together a special juice, coconut water and watermelon juice and then green juices. And Elaine Ryan, our massage therapist, came down, set up a table in case anybody got any sore legs or cramps. And everybody started cheering. Here's what was funny. They thought they were going to be there for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. They were there for 5 hours. Every single one of those people finished a marathon, including that woman. It shocked her. And she said she had never felt that good. And she stayed on her protocol and lost a tremendous amount of weight, is doing great. She's probably listening right now. And I gave them all my own national championship medals. And one of the people said, why are you giving us a national championship medal? I said, because what you did today took more effort than what I, as a trained athlete, did to win the national gold. So anytime you don't believe you can do something, put that above, you know, your bedroom mirror on the wall and remind yourself you did that. Ask anyone training for a marathon. Could they go out without any training whatsoever. They'd never done a mile and do 26 miles. One guy, Ron, did 30 miles. No, it's not possible. But it was for these people. If Jesse has that, he'll let me know in a moment, and we'll play it. Otherwise, we're going to take a break now that I've given you a whole lot on this whole idea of inflammation. I want you to have the larger view, because if you have the larger view, then you see why it's so important to select people in your life that are anti-inflammatory, meaning they're fun to be with, they're not a hassle, they're not judging you every other second, they're not acting like a perfectionist to which you are somehow incapable of understanding how to do things right, and always complaining, and these little sniping comments that are so irritating. It's no different than eating junk food. It's like having a choice. Oh, here comes Bob or here comes Barbara. They're going to talk to me about what's wrong in my life. Why don't I just go over to that little pigsty and put some garbage in there and get down and eat like a pig? Because the outcome on my body, my cells, my self-esteem are going to be about the same. That's a visualization, isn't it? Okay. Jesse just says, I've not found it yet, but I'll keep searching. Good. And also, when it comes to berries, you just can't do enough. I don't tell people how much of anything I do each day. Once someone was standing at a juice bar down in the village, and I just had a juice made, and I said, please wash in front of me the wheatgrass, but it's just come out of a bag. I said, yeah, and I don't know whose hands it touched. I don't know if they were clean or not when it went in the bag. So the guy seemed a little irritated, but that's all right. He washed the wheatgrass, and he just kept, I said, no, I don't want 2 ounces. Keep going. I drank 16 ounces. The guy standing beside me says, I'll do one of those. I said, don't. I wouldn't. You got to build up to it. No. You do it. I can do it. I wouldn't suggest it. So I said, don't give him 16. Give him half that, 8 ounces. He got 3 drinks and it just projectile vomited right across the room. So I don't tell people what I eat, but if anyone's ever seen me eat, I eat very little. I'm a small eater. For a big guy, and it's only 2.8% body fat, so it's not fat. It's knowing what to eat that supplies your body with what it needs, and we're eating a lot of calories that don't help us at ages. Caloric restriction is the one thing you can do to lengthen your lifespan. Every single analysis, every meta-analysis have proven that. By the way, when it comes to meta-analysis, let me explain a little more deeply, because some people listening clearly were not listening to what I was saying. A meta, M-E-T-A, analysis means it's a quantitative, more often than not, epidemiological study. And they're looking for confirmatory conclusions, meaning there were 5 people in 5 different parts of the world who did studies on taking vitamin C, and it was able to reduce the common cold from 60 to 80%, or the duration of a cold by 30 to 40%. That means that they're looking for multiple studies to observe and look at the outcomes and see if they can develop a more precise estimate of the treatment, its benefits, its risks. If they're looking at a meta-analysis of fruits and vegetables, what kind of fruits and vegetables, how many servings you have to eat. But it's never just one, because one doesn't give you confirmatory conclusions. You have to have many. So when I'm talking about many, that doesn't mean literally meta is many. What it literally means is you're looking for quantitative epidemiological markers that show you conclusions you can reasonably draw based upon multiple studies being done. I have a lot of anal people in this audience, unfortunately. I can promise you they don't have a lot of fiber. They wouldn't be a lot of fun to be around. Yes, we would, Gary. We'd judge you to death. Good luck with that. Back in a moment with some real people giving us some of their issues. I haven't heard them. We will hear them together in just a moment on our talkback line.
Thank you. my name is Stephanie. I'm in New York City, and I am calling to notify the troops that the Assembly Health Committee is bringing on A2371 for a vote this Tuesday. We need everyone in Albany that can get to Albany. This is a critical, critical time. Autism Action Network has a plan listed available, and I would love to connect regarding the removal of a first freedom, the freedom of religion, a removal of a civil right, segregating children who are not vaccinated out of classrooms and denying them their education. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Also, how can we get the IOM to demand that the science becomes done on the childhood schedule of vaccinations of primary importance to me? Thank you, Gary, for all you do. Really, I love.
Okay, good. I'm hopeful people in this audience will be there. I'm sorry I'm out on the road. I can't be there. But if I was in New York, I can promise you I would be there, as I have been for hundreds of demonstrations with this audience. And so please get up to Albany, be there. And to the second part, anyone who represents a group that's going to be there, please contact Jay Greger, my art director in my office in New York. It's 646-926-5442. If you're from a legitimate group, we will make copies of Deadly Deception. That's the last of the four documentaries I've done on vaccines, and that will help. Also, we will prepare an article that's already done on the mandated vaccines like Gardasil and MMR. We have articles on both showing you the lack of science and efficacy and how dangerous they are, and there's no good science supporting that they're going to help people and a lot that they can hurt people. So if you take the articles and the documentaries and you give them to the demonstrations, but more importantly, give them to the legislators, we believe that that will help. Okay? We'll take another call.
Hello. There's been a fire recently in the Kearney area of New Jersey. There was a fire, chemical plant fire, where it released chlorine into the sky. I don't know how the whole basis of this other science, but is there any concerns for the surrounding areas that we should be aware of?
Okay, I need more information. How far are you located from the accident? If you contact the state environmental group will tell you which chemicals were released, not just chlorine, and is it continuing to release? If you have one burst out of a containment vessel, it depends upon the chemicals and their volatility. Some of those chlorine compounds can last for seconds, moments, hours, and other chemicals can last indefinitely. They're what we call forever chemicals. And then I would not trust the state. I would get myself an indoor, very high-quality air filter and keep it on. So at least you know that you're not having a problem inside your immediate vicinity. But again, I don't know how far you are from this. I need more information. If you could give me more information, I could give you more details. But I would get as much information as possible, so at least you know if it's something to be very concerned about or something that is being taken care of. I'm going to come back in a little bit. We have another guest coming up in the last part of our program. And that guest is Deborah Copaid, and she is an environmental consultant to physicians and attorneys on environmental-related illnesses, and she's developed and overseen for passage of legislation initiatives to protect the public from our cell tower radiation and wireless technologies, and she and I are going to talk about the dangers right now in our legislations, both state and federal, of special interest passing 5G, without showing the real dangers of this. All right? And Deborah holds degrees from Harvard University and MIT, Sloan School of Management. So we look forward to her in a little bit. I'm very concerned. I know many in this audience are concerned. I also know others don't seem to care. We should care about what kind of data the government and special corporations, major, major corporations like Google and Facebook and Wikipedia, are collecting. There is a statement by Professor Yuval Noah Harari. Here's what he says. I want to thank John Whitehead for providing this. Quote, as more and more data flows from your body and brain to the smart machines via the biometric sensors, it will become easy for corporations, government agencies to know you, manipulate you, and make decisions on your behalf. Even more importantly, they could decipher the deep mechanisms of all bodies and brains, and therefore gain the power to engineer life. If we want to prevent a small elite from monopolizing such godlike powers, and if we want to prevent humankind from splitting into biological castes, the key question is, who owns the data? Does the data about your DNA, your brain, and your life belong to you, to the government, to a corporation, or to a human collective? End quote. Well, that says a lot. Yesterday I posted a article about how Google is now or has completed research on how to put a chip into a youngster in the brain that can then answer all the questions that that child would have. It's here now. So what are we looking at? We're looking at the government and the corporations wanting your DNA. So I'm suggesting that we prepare ourselves. How's this happening? It could only happen because Congress, which adopted legislation allowing police to collect and test DNA immediately following arrest, and the president, who signed the Rapid DNA Act into law, the courts, which have ruled that police can routinely take DNA samples from people who are arrested but not yet convicted of a crime, and local police agencies, are all embarking on a diabolical campaign to create a nation of suspects predicated on a massive national DNA database. Here's what the New York Times says on this. And again, I want to thank John Whitehead for this. Quote, the science fiction future in which police can swiftly identify robbers and murderers from discarded soda cans and cigarette butts has arrived. In 2017, President Trump signed into law the Rapid DNA Act, which starting this year will enable approved police booking stations in several states to connect their rapid DNA machines to CODIS, that's C-O-D-I-S, the National DNA Database. Genetic fingerprinting is set to become as routine as old-fashioned kind, end quote. Have you seen all the new ads where you've got privacy because your iris and your fingerprint are the only thing that will open up your cell phone? Who do you think is going to now have your iris and your fingerprint? Every dystopian sci-fi film we've ever seen is suddenly converging into this present moment in a dangerous trifecta between science, technology, and a government that wants to be all-seeing, all-knowing, and all-powerful. By tapping into your phone lines and cell phone communications, the government knows what you say. By uploading all of your emails, opening your mail, and reading your Facebook posts and text messages, the government knows what you write. By monitoring your movements with the use of license plate readers, surveillance cameras, and other tracking devices, the government knows where you go, how long you stay, and when you return. By churning through all the data of your life, what you read, where you go, what you say, the government can predict what you will do. By mapping the synapses in your brain, scientists in turn and the government will know what you remember, and they will have access to all your memories. And by accessing your DNA, the government will soon know everything else about you that they don't already know. Your family chart, your ancestry, what you look like, your health history, your inclination to follow orders or chart your own course, etc. And of course, none of these technologies are foolproof, nor are they immune from tampering, hacking, or user bias. Nevertheless, they have become a convenient tool in the hands of government agents to render null and void the Constitution's requirements of privacy and its prohibitions against unreasonable searches and seizures. Consequently, no longer Are we innocent until proven guilty? In the face of DNA evidence that places at the scene of a crime behavior, sensing technology that interprets your body temperature and facial tics as suspicious, and government surveillance devices that cross-check our biometrics, license plates, and DNA against a growing database of unsolved crimes and potential criminals. The government's questionable acquisition and use of DNA to identify individuals and supposedly solve crimes has come under particular scrutiny in recent years. And until recently, the government was required to at least observe some basic restrictions on when and where and how it could access someone's DNA. That has all been turned on its head by various U.S. Supreme Court rulings that paved the way for suspicionless searches and held the loss of privacy on a cellular level. Certainly, it was difficult enough trying to protect our privacy in the wake of the 2013 Supreme Court ruling of Maryland versus King that likened DNA collection to photographing and fingerprinting suspects when they were booked, thereby allowing the government to take DNA samples from people merely arrested in connection with crimes. Justice Scalia's dissent in Maryland versus King is worth reading, not only for the history lesson on the Fourth Amendment, but for its clear-sighted rebuke of the police state's tendency to justify every encroachment on our freedoms as necessary for security. Quote, "Solving unsolved crimes is a noble objective, but it occupies a lower place in the American pantheon of noble objectives than the protection of our people from suspicionless law enforcement searches. Make no mistake about it. As an entirely predictable consequence of today's decision, your DNA can be taken and entered into a national DNA database if you are ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, and for whatever reason. Today's judgments will, to be sure, have the beneficial effect of solving more crimes than, again, so would taking the DNA sample from anyone who flies on an airplane." Okay? And also applies for a driver's license or attends a public school. Perhaps the construction of such a genetic center is wise, but I doubt that the proud men who wrote the Charter of our liberties would have been so eager to open their mouths for royal inspection, end quote. Something for us to think about. The court's decision to let stand the Maryland Court of Appeals ruling in Raynor versus Maryland, which essentially determined that individuals who do not have a right to privacy when it comes to their DNA, made Americans even more vulnerable to the government's accessing and analyzing and storing their DNA without their knowledge or permission. Although Glenn Raynor, a suspect rapist, willingly agreed to be questioned by police, he refused to provide them with the DNA sample. No problem, police simply swabbed the chair in which he had been sitting and took what he refused to voluntarily provide. Raynor's DNA was a match and the suspect became a convict. As the dissenting opinion in Raynor for Maryland Court of Appeals rightly warned, quote, "A person desiring to keep her DNA profile private must conduct her public affairs in a hermetically sealed hazmat suit. The majority's holdings means that a person can no longer vote, participate in a jury, or obtain a driver's license without opening up his genetic material for state collection and codification," end quote. And yet, in refusing to hear the case, U.S. Supreme Court gave its tacit approval for government agents to collect DNA, likening to a person's fingerprints or the color of their hair, eyes, and skin. Whereas fingerprint technology created a watershed moment for police and their ability to crack a case, DNA technology is now being held by law enforcement agencies as the magic bullet in crime solving. It's what police like to refer to as modern fingerprint. However, unlike a fingerprint, the DNA print reveals everything about who you are, where you come from, and who you'll be. And with such a powerful tool at their disposal, it was inevitable that the government's collection of DNA would become a slippery slope towards government intrusion. All 50 states now maintain their own DNA databases. Although the protocols for collection differ from state to state, increasingly, many of the data from local data banks are being uploaded to CODIS, that's the Combined DNA Index System, the FBI's massive DNA database, which has become a de facto way to identify and crack the American people from birth to death. They're tracking everything. Even hospitals have gotten into the game by taking and storing newborn babies' DNA, often without their parents' knowledge or consent. is part of the government's mandatory genetic screening of newborns. However, in many states, the DNA is stored indefinitely. What this means for those being born today is inclusion in a government database that contains intimate information about who they are, their ancestry, and what awaits them in the future, including their inclinations to be followers, leaders, or troublemakers. And for the rest of us, it's just a matter of time before the government gets hold of your DNA, either through mandatory programs carried out in connection with law enforcement and corporate America, by warrantless accessing our family DNA shared with genealogical services such as Ancestry and 23andMe, or through the collection of our shed or touch DNA. All these fascinating geologically and ancestral searches allow you to trace your family tree. Now it also allows the government to do the same. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Before we go to our guest, we are going to take 40 seconds because we believe we found that woman who lost all that weight, lost over 100 points in her blood sugar, and did a full marathon.
Hi, I'm Michelle, and when I came to Gary's retreat, the reason why I came here was to control my blood sugar. I knew that if my blood sugar remained out of control, that my diabetes would lead to more serious conditions later on in life. When I arrived here last Sunday, my blood sugar was 187. This morning, when I measured it, it was 80. I was expecting my blood sugar to lower some, but not to be completely normal. Gary's protocol is amazing, and I would recommend anybody buy his book and follow his protocol because it does work.
We just did it abbreviated. She went on to talk about what it was like to go out and where she couldn't walk a block, she walked 26 miles, and now is an athlete and doing great. Let's say hello to Deborah Copeland. Nice to have you with us today, Deborah.
Thanks for having me back, Gary.
Deborah, I want you to begin with some comments about why G5 is so dangerous and why the media is not covering it at all, except to be pro-G5, like the New York Times is pro-G5. And we need the audience to understand this bipartisan bill in Washington to push 5G, and that none of the presidential candidates are talking about it, and how the FCC regulations will force 5G technology onto private property. You'll have no say-so, and smart meters are not connected with G5, and I want to talk about those risks. So take us through this from A to Z.
You're absolutely right, and I hope that your listeners have read your very excellent article that you wrote with Rich Gale on your website, Race Towards Extinction, Climate Change versus 5G. And it's an important article to read. Other articles that are in the press right now include 5G Unreported Health Threat on Medium.com by Deborah Davis, who is on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Mercola has a piece on his site, The 5G War, Technology versus Humanity. Similar title on Gaia.com, 5G Health Risks, The War Between Technology and Human Beings. And Gabriel Cousins has a piece as well, The Toxic Assault on the Planet, on his website. So people need to read these articles, but in a nutshell, you know, we are beyond precaution at this point. There's plenty of evidence that there is a huge public health problem at power densities, well lower than those that come from 5G. A lot of the issue has to come from the fact that when you're closer to these 5G small cells, because to operate they need to be every few hundred feet on poles, literally outside people's houses. But a lot of what people don't know about 5G is that it also has to work in conjunction with 4G, so that the 4G cell towers are going to be coming in closer to people's homes, businesses, areas that they frequent as well. And, you know, if you go back to the fact that we needed to have cell towers 1,500 feet away to, you know, have lower rates of cancer, not fully protective, but that was sort of the level at which the radiation power density dropped off. We are at intensities well beyond that. For a cell phone to operate in a town, you need minus 85 dBm, that's your decibel milliwatts. 5G will have a directed beam that can go into your house at 53 decibel milliwatts. It's well over the 10 trillion times levels of background radiation. It's likely to breach FCC limits in the vicinity, which are up to a million times higher than levels that can trigger electrosensitivity in people, people who can't tolerate Wi-Fi, cell phones, smart meters, cell towers, and the like. And, of course, in 2017, we offshored this bad news. The National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences had a joint conference at Hebrew University with the Israel Institute for Advanced Studies, where they referenced studies from Los Alamos and Brooks Air Force Base that showed that this radiation breaks DNA, has been used by the military for crowd control, so it affects people's behavior, and it affects human sweat glands and sweat enzymes. And on May 31st, Toronto Women's College Hospital had a conference on this that was hosted by Frank Clegg, former head of Microsoft Canada, who's warning that we need to have a moratorium on 5G, which the Europeans have done as well. They've said it's a violation of the Nuremberg Code. So this really shouldn't be in doubt. And in fact, four members of Congress, Senator Blumenthal, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo from California, Tom Suozzi from Long Island, and Peter DeFazio from Oregon, wrote to the FCC in recent weeks and months to say, effectively, Houston, we have a problem, a health problem with these 5G frequencies. So that background, and you mentioned the New York Times, they are a large source of the problem. They wrote a piece recently claiming that any concerns about 5G are a Russian hoax. A little hard to explain when our own government is saying there's a problem. And as well, you have the Department of Labor and the Access Board, as well as branches of the military, saying that people who are sensitized to microwave radiation need accommodation. The cities of Boston and Philadelphia wrote to the FCC in 2013 saying the same, that if you roll out more of these transmitters and closer, you're going to have problems with people being able to access things. A recent study in the Journal of Epidemiology said it's now one out of 254 people who cannot access the indoor building environment because of even Wi-Fi and cell phones. So, you know, this is a public health problem. And yet, not only does the New York Times claim it's a Russian hoax, but you have, they had an advertorial last Sunday with Verizon where they went on to say, oh, 5G is wonderful. It's going to save you from cancer. It was a very misleading claim because they're talking about using it to transmit data in operating rooms. You can transmit that data via wire just as well, and in fact, more robustly and more safely, but they've kind of gotten in everyone's heads that they don't want wires around, but that yet they've created a problem in the hospital. Hospitals in Europe do not use all this radiation. They have wings without it because they know that there's this portion of the population that gets extreme symptoms from it, you know, overt symptoms, and can't get medical care without it. And so City and State Magazine had a conference with Verizon recently where they're promoting 5G. They wouldn't have David Carpenter there. They wouldn't have me there, Deborah Davis, any of the people. David Carpenter's on the presidential cancer panel, and he's at SUNY Albany. They wouldn't have anybody there to speak about the health effects. I called Gail Brewer's office. She's the Manhattan Borough president. I said, you're speaking on this conference, and you need to acknowledge the fact that there is this huge problem. Nothing, you know, no acknowledgement. That was the end of it. So, and if you go back to the New York Times, why is there this problem? You know, it's the same conflicts of interest with all the other topics that you and I care about. If Carlos Slim Helou is the majority shareholder of the New York Times, at last count, $45 billion of his net worth was from wireless and telecom. And sort of the tale of the tape, when I actually tweeted a number of years ago when they were tarring and feathering Nick Bilton, who was a reporter who wrote about the health effects from wireless wearables, they tolerated the tweets, you know, about the science. But when I mentioned that Carlos Slim Helou, the majority shareholder, and there's a conflict of interest, they deleted, the public editor deleted that tweet. That tells you everything you need to know. And in fact, in the late 1980s, with their first electromagnetic radiation crisis, which came from video display terminals, the New York Times was defending a lawsuit against their, their data entry clerks who were having eye strain and miscarriages, et cetera, from the radiation. And they said, oh, there's no problem. They had a very famous editorial at the time called Suffolk Screen Scream, sort of pillaring Suffolk County for putting in legislation to protect workers who had to use video display terminals in county government. And shortly after that editorial, IBM was forced to yank these video display terminals off the market and completely redesign them. So the New York Times has no credibility on this issue, and they really effectively jumped the shark by calling it a Russian hoax. And people need to write to them. But more importantly, because I'm not sure the New York Times is going to change the way it does business, is we now have a problem where the Thune and Schatz, Senators Thune and Schatz, have reintroduced the Streamlined Small Cell Deployment Act. You and I talked about it on February 17th, 2017, on your show, where we also talked about the privacy and health effects of 5G. And they've now reintroduced that bill. The FCC had passed regulations in the fall of 2018 where they were basically going to sort of promote 5G and make it, easier.
Deborah, we're running out of time. Just quickly tell people what they need to do. Give us a number that they can call to complain about this bill.
They're going to have to call Senator Schumer's office because he's the leader, obviously. And they're going to have to talk to him about yanking the bill because Schatz keeps pushing it as if it's non-constitutional.
What's Senator Schumer's number? He's the top Democrat in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to give you a few other people to call. So if you go online, you can find every congressman and senator's phone number. But they're also going to need to speak to Mike Doyle and call for hearings on the congressional side, the House of Representatives. And they're going to have to speak with leadership over there, Pelosi and Hoyer. And they're going to have to speak to Schatz's office, to Senator Schumer, most importantly, and Dick Durbin, who's the whip. Now, Klobuchar and Warren are in leadership.
I'm sorry, we're out of time, and our station is going to be cutting away. I'm going to do a whole hour on this Tuesday in the Progressive Commentary. I'll invite you back so we can go into greater depth. But this is timely. We must start calling Senator Schumer and all the other representatives that she just mentioned today. Write them, email them, and that way we can start voicing our protests against the reenactment of this particular bill and show our displeasure at the lack of scientific scrutiny within the government of 5G technology. Thank you very much, Deborah Copeland. We'll see you on Tuesday. For everyone else, nice to have you with us today. Have a wonderful day.
And take